Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we convene the Science Forum. We've gathered three brilliant people to answer your questions about things ranging from hanging laundry out to dry to how fast ice melts in the freezer. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also post your comments below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. You can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number to call is 800-348-2551. Of course, everybody is talking about the discovery of gravity waves, so we've assembled a panel of three brilliant physicists to talk about it today. Let's meet our panel of experts.
The non-physicist biochemist, Barbara Brabets from SUNY Cobleskill, although my master's degree did come out of the Center for Biophysics at RPI.
You see, that's what I'm talking about. And another physicist is here.
Yeah, I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist and not a physicist.
Oh, all right. Well, maybe the third one's a charm.
But I am a physical organic chemist.
You're here, physically. Yes. And I can feel the gravity waves.
Ed Stander, I'm a geologist, and I do physical geology.
I teach
physical geology.
Who booked this program on such a momentous day?
Are you thinking psychics? Is that what you're thinking we are?
That's at astrologers.
We're all psychics.
We did the astrology show yesterday with
perfect.
Bob Berman. Yeah, it was pretty exciting.
We will pick up messages as well by telemetry as necessary.
All right, now
via gravity wave.
Yes. So, but I mean, this was big news. This it happened in September that they I guess they finally verified it, and now they're ready to release this information today. Gravity waves have been detected. At last. So Einstein was right all along.
Who would have thought? Yes. But I think this is a big deal because...
Well, thank you for agreeing with me. Everybody else seems to think it's nothing.
I mean, they put a lot of hardware in the ground, this big detector.
Three or four big detectors.
And for a number of years they were running, but not sensitive enough to detect anything.
Cars in the parking lots and things like that.
Yeah. Somebody sneezed in Urbana.
This is an extraordinarily difficult experiment to do.
Okay, so as I understand the experiment, there are two L-shaped, for lack of a better term, antennas made of very polished glass that are the 2.5 miles each leg of this L.
Right.
And they're basically, they did some upgrade work to isolate them from vibration.
Yeah. As best as they can.
Right. Yeah. And because these gravity waves are so faint... that you have to measure. So they shoot a laser through these, and then they reflect back, supposedly in sync. And if they're out of phase, then you get a detection.
If they're deformed, then you know that there's another force acting upon them that isn't accounted for, the so-called gravity wave.
So why is this a big deal for everybody?
Because pretty well everything we know about astronomy comes from the electromagnetic spectrum. Light and radio waves and things like that. And those can be interfered by everything else in space. So, for example, a radio wave coming from one source could be affected by everything along the way. But apparently the gravity waves are not. And they are a totally different form of energy. So we can use them not only to support what we see with light, but they also give us more information, such as they're effectively the same as sound, for example. In fact, as I understand it, when they first took the gravity waves, they ran them through an audio... a radio and heard the boom.
Well, it sounds like a Hanna-Barbera sound effect. If you've heard it online, the way they have converted it to audio, it sounds like something you'd hear in a cartoon. Very similar to that, yeah. So this is a big deal sort of on many levels, and we'll probably find out over the coming years just how big it is. But one of them is it tends to confirm now something we can't see, and that's a black hole.
That's right. And, I mean, one of the things that I just... read about this. So you had two black holes, presumably, orbiting
each other,
and then the boing sound was them basically going down the drain,
colliding and becoming
one. Coalescing. And in the process, turning, a half dozen suns' masses into energy.
The equivalent of a billion suns or something like that, right? For a split second?
Well, the E equals MC squared. I mean, all that mass going into energy. Which is a lot of energy.
Which is something to think about. It means that we've we've recorded something so infinitely small at our level, at our position, but the amount of energy that was produced by this when it happened was approximately the same as the entire universe for that second.
Right. Yeah.
So it's like a giant boom, and we're hearing the boom.
Yeah, we're hearing the echo of the echo of the echo of the echo of the echo.
1.3 billion years later.
Yeah. So the gravity waves travel at the speed of light, but they get progressively weaker, and we're 1.2 billion
Thank
light
heavens.
Years away.
If they didn't, we'd be in big trouble.
I would have to have earplugs for the big boom. Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we've covered that pretty well, and you've all acquitted yourselves very well.
It's only started.
Okay. Well, there's a long way to this the end of this train wreck, certainly. 800-348-2551 is the number. Let's go to the phones, and Merle in Argyle. Merle, you're first.
All right. This is a question down to earth. This has to do with burning wood.
Okay.
I got two trees, one a live maple, one a dead maple. I cut them down and I burn them. Which one is going to give me the most heat?
The dead
After
maple.
I'll assume that we season both for a year.
Well, if they're seasoned,
they're both dead.
Then they're both dead and dry. So that's really what you want. You want dead and dry. The issue between the live wood and the recently live wood and the recently or long seasoned wood is the amount of moisture in the wood that you're going to have to drive off through heating. So when something burns in a conventional manner, you're really burning the gases that escape from the solid object. That's what's actually combusting. So that's why we only see flames on the surface. We don't see them inside the wood. It's on the surface of the wood. So you're going to have to gasify the carbon material that the wood is made out of. In order to get it to that state, first you got to drive off the water. You kind of have to heat the pan long enough for the water to dry out before you burn your pasta into a black crisp. So if we start with dry, we burn our pasta quicker, right? So dry wood burns more completely and with more heat released than wet wood.
And a really easy way to see that is to take a paper cup and fill it with water and put a flame underneath it. And as long as the water's in the paper cup, the flame will not burn the cup because the water has to be driven off in order to get hot enough to allow the cup to burn.
Okay.
So the initial heat that you put into the wood stove, you know, burning the little fuel or whatever to get the big logs to go, that goes to drive the water off first. So you're losing all of that initial input of energy.
So that doesn't really matter if the tree is just alive and then seasoned for a year and one is dead for several years.
The dead for several years might actually reduce the fuel value if some of the carbon based stuff inside starts rotting away.
Yeah,
it starts getting eaten by fungus.
Punky wood. Yeah. Yep.
If it gets funky, I can understand that. Right. I was just thank you very much.
Hey, Merle, thank you very much. 800-348-2551.
A point for Merle, there are certain types of wood that take longer than one season to season. You know, some of the wetter, more resinous woods take longer than one summer before they're ready for, they're optimized for burning. So,
okay.
But maple's not one of them. It seasons pretty quickly.
Fair enough. And how quickly?
A season should do it.
All right. Let's go to John in Pittsfield. John.
Yes, this has to do with gravity waves, which you were just talking about.
You have three experts here.
Heavens.
This is great. Good.
Yeah.
And it concerns detection and how accurate can the detection be with just one detector. I would think
two.
You'd need another one on the other side of the Earth or something like that in order to really verify it.
Yeah, well, they did have two.
Because there's so many interference ways that could mimic it, you know, earthquake, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, right. Well, the answer is...
I would think you'd need... Okay.
The answer is that they did have two detectors.
One was in Washington,
oh, okay.
One was in Louisiana.
Louisiana. And for exactly that reason. And at least what I saw, the signal was identical from the two. And then you would expect there to be a slight delay because of
right,
speed
right.
of the light.
And what there
to
was?
One to the other. presumably.
And also, okay. Remember, they found this out last year, and then they didn't release that information until today because several scores of scientists have looked this over who are better experts in gravity waves than the people around this table.
No way.
Excuse me.
Right. Although it is a new phenomenon, but people who are esteemed
well,
in the
Kip
field.
Thorne is,
right. So they would have had to look over the data with just that same skeptical eye. That's all part of the process.
And I would imagine they would have to check seismic records around the world and everything
sure.
else, right?
Yep. Right.
Yeah, it took them 4 months.
All right. Well, here's a quick one from that came in via email at voxpopwamc.org, and then we'll take a break. My question is about whether we've had for most of this, the weather we've had for most of this winter season and the effect it will have on insects, especially ticks. Because we've had so little snow and mostly mild temperatures, are we in for a bumper crop of insects? I assume there will be a similar effect for deer, squirrels, and other mammals. That's from Laura. 30 seconds, panel. Go.
Well, yes, ticks are affected by not having a really, really hard freeze. Now, we're about to have in the Albany area a pretty hard freeze over this coming weekend. That may be long enough to really help with the tick explosion. One of the things that scientists have found, though, is that a really wet spring impacts ticks in a negative way.
Huh.
There seems to be some kind of bacterial, community bacterial infection that they can get that does actually suppress their fertility.
All right.
So
and there also is
hope for a wet spring.
There's also the fact that they go in cycles depending on the amount of, for example, white-footed mice that are around that act as one of the vectors for the ticks.
Let's take a break here. The number to call is 800-348-2551. We'll be back.
Support comes from Pine Cobble School, Williamstown, Massachusetts, where yoga is a weekly part of the curriculum for early childhood students. A good beginning never ends. Pinecobble.org. Apex Solar Power, Queensbury, New York. Locally owned, installing solar panels, solar hot water, solar pool heating. ApexSolarPower.com for information. The Arthur Zankel Music Center at Skidmore College, presenting Carnegie Hall's ensemble ACJW, performing works by Mozart, Beethoven, and Hummel, February 12th at 8 p.m. Skidmore.edu/ZANKEL. And Agricultural Stewardship Association, helping people conserve farmland in the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve good farmland for good forever. agstewardship.org.
Yes. Thank you, boys. Lovely music. That's 800-348-2551. That is the theremin. Wonderful music here on Vox Pop.
Let's have some questions about theremins. I can answer those.
Very nice. So there are two different kinds, right?
No, there's only one kind of theremin.
Well, I thought there was one that would affect pitch and one would affect amplitude.
There's two antennas on a theremin.
Right.
And the two do that. Although things like Good Vibrations was actually not played on a theremin.
Oh, really?
Although most people think it was. It was just a ring on a oscillator, and they would move their finger back and forth.
Oh, that makes it a lot easier.
Much easier.
Much easier. I saw Jimmy Page use one in concert one time, and wasn't very good at it.
No, and amazingly, the price of theremins didn't go up after that. I was really pissed.
Well, thanks. All right, thanks for that. I appreciate that language. Al in Rotterdam. Al, you're on.
Hi, how's it going? Thank you, panel.
Fabulous. Thank you. Nice to have you here.
I'm just wondering, back to gravitational waves, if, like, with this new information, the experts have predicted when it's going to be practical to, you know, down here in society, when maybe it'll be used for, you know, interstellar transportation, et cetera, and all that.
Good question. Panel, you're the experts.
If a gravity wave comes by and you're standing on a scale, for example, your weight would go down for a second.
Well, at least oscillate.
Yeah, and that's a good thing.
I could take a selfie with me weighing less. That would be nice.
And I imagine it could be used. They could use gravity waves to send communication.
That's what I was thinking.
I was thinking about modulating it yesterday when we were talking about that.
But it's only in one direction so far. We'd have to blow up the Earth to get a gravity wave
large enough to send it out from here. Big mass-to-energy conversion.
It wouldn't do much, no. But somebody else may have a better receiver.
So, like a gravitational Wi-Fi?
Yeah.
I like it.
Okay, so we're going to work on that, Al. Thank you for the call. And let's go to Richard in Schenectady. Richard, you're on.
Yes. Hi, everyone.
Hi.
This question is similar to the one a couple ago, but I decided it was different enough not to hang up. So it's about as the climate warms up in agriculture, what do farmers in Mexico and other countries warmer than ours do? Do they use a lot more insecticides than we do here? And if we have to vary our crops as the climate gets warmer, what are crops might we not be able to grow anymore in this country?
Well, I'm teaching a water chemistry course this semester, so I'm going to answer with the obvious answer to me, which is really it has to do with water supply as the climate changes, because we're getting more extremes of climate as far as hydrological cycles go. So where water deposits. So wet places are getting wetter and dry places are getting drier. So that changes, yes, what insects are there, but, you know, crops are very water dependent. If you take the water away from it, you can add all the herbicide and pesticide you want, but unless you're adding water to the system, to the field, you're not going to get your crop. That has affected wheat as the drought in Texas and Oklahoma progressed through the 90s and 2000s, and that continues to happen. Actually, what happens is the northern expanse of where you can plant wheat has increased. So as we've had warmer Midwestern winters, the wheat crop can actually creep north through Kansas into Nebraska and Minnesota. I would buy land in Canada for farming if I were you.
All right, Richard, thank you so much. It's the Science Forum. Go ahead.
No, I'll just mention that some places like Saudi Arabia are now buying land in Arizona because the Saudis have told them they can't plant water-intensive crops there anymore. And so they're actually planting alfalfa in the middle of the desert in Arizona.
Did you see that they're putting a massive solar array up? I think
yes.
It was in Morocco?
Yes, yep.
That's incredible.
Good place for a solar array, though.
That would be a place, not necessarily in Morocco, but I would think if you have lots of solar panels, it could potentially defray the
heat load.
Would also defray the costs of desalination.
Yes.
I mean, that's an expensive process.
That's one of the main reasons. They need the power.
Yeah. The biggest desalinators in the world are in the Middle East, and they're run mostly on oil and oil product right now. So they're having to figure out a way to transition.
Let's see. Quickly here, before we get back to the phones at 800-348-2551, a couple of emails came in. Why don't mosquito-borne illnesses such as malaria or dengue develop in our upstate region? That's from Daniel.
Specific type of
is he wishing
mosquito.
For this?
We don't have the right mosquitoes.
Yeah, we don't have the right winter hardy mosquito yet.
Okay.
Yeah. So going back to the last question, if the climates make it so that we don't have the traditional winters that we've grown up with in the last 50 years, then those mosquitoes can exist. That's what happened with West Nile virus and how it was able to come into the Northeast is that the mosquito was only marginally available, but our winters got warmer, and so the mosquito could persist, and the birds could then get bit and transmit.
Unfortunately, the anopheles mosquito hasn't made it yet.
Yes.
All right, Barbara Rabbits is here, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander. And in layman's terms, will the discovery of, this is from David Kay. David Kay, sounds familiar. In layman's terms, will the discovery of these gravitational waves affect things that are digital or anything that we use every day? Thanks, David from Albany.
Short answer would be no.
Haven't so far.
They've already been there. It's just that we've only discovered them.
Detected them.
I'm sorry. Detected.
And as far as their effect on anything, you have to go to extraordinary lengths to detect them.
So far.
If they had a significant effect on our daily lives, we would have found them a long time ago.
Been dead long ago.
Yeah.
So it just went through.
Einstein, was there any question really for a long time that Einstein was right about this?
There was significant debate in the scientific community, which is healthy. Debate is a healthy way to make sure that your hypothesis is supported by the facts that have been gathered to that point. Yeah. In fact, the fluidity of what we know and what we can detect allows us to refine a hypothesis if we're slightly off
or
if we're bogus.
Without that, why bother going to a bar?
Was there nothing to talk about at a bar if we don't talk science?
We just talk about bars, yeah. Okay. Talk about gravity waves.
You think that's going to be going on? Well, let's go across the street and we'll do it. We'll do an experiment and see if anyone's talking about it.
They're talking about it here, so we're there.
Hey, there's a dog on the line. Hello, Spot, you're on. Charlie, are you there?
Hi. Oh, yes, I am. I have an observation. We're talking today about gravity. Now, the Earth is covered with water. We know that the deeper we go into the ocean, the pressure increases. I'm wondering whether deep ocean pressure could be another source of sustainable energy. Visualize a hydraulic system where you step on the brake and that your pressure is instantly transferred to the brakes, or a clown holding one of those long, skinny balloons. He squeezes on one end, and the same pressure comes out the other end. I was wondering whether that is a possibility.
Well, the problem being,
yeah, distance.
Yeah, is in order to exploit energy, you have to have a difference in the energy from
one point to another.
So that you can get a flow. The problem there, so you have enormous pressure down below, you have just atmospheric pressure up above, but they're a long ways away. Yeah. And trying to, when you transmit that pressure, the energy goes away. I mean, if you put a pipe, mm-hmm. imagine putting a pipe down to the bottom of the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
The water doesn't come squirting out of the top of the pipe despite the great pressure under there because the column of water is pressing down on it.
Yeah.
So there is simply no way to exploit that energy without putting more energy in than you would get out.
It does work on the small scale.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we use it for in places where the water comes into a small bay and then has to rush back out
yes.
again. And in that situation, it's the weight of the water that's behind the dam during a tidal cycle that produces the energy. So
yeah.
on small scale, it works.
Yeah.
But
that's a good way to explain it is for hydroelectric power, the reason that it works is you have water that's higher on one side of the dam and lower on the other side. And in the process of dropping that water down, you can extract energy out of it.
Hmm.
There are actually commercial pressure transducers that you can put under a speed bump, for example, where you know you're going to have traffic that's pushing down because of gravity on that surface. And they can collect that little bit of energy and then usually use it to light a sign that says speed bump. But, you know, at least it's something. So
there's
ways to do that.
I invented a wonderful idea years and years ago. of a pipe going from a reservoir down to a town. You put a bunch of vanes in there that would rotate as the water ran through it, and that would produce energy. And everyone laughed at me, and there's now a company out in Chicago that's making them and probably making a fortune on my idea.
Ah.
But basically, anytime you go from a high level to a low level, you're using gravity to produce energy.
All right, let's go to Bob in Clifton Park. Bob, you're on.
I apologize if this was covered earlier, but I was not listening to the very beginning of the program. The detectors for the gravity waves use lasers, and I think the laser light is much bigger than a proton, yet they're able to detect something that's a motion that's 1/10,000th of the diameter of a proton. And could you explain that?
Yeah, what's happening is that you've effectively got the light bouncing off of a reflective surface at the other end, and as the gravity wave comes through, it's changing the distance between the start and the finish of that light wave by a very, very small fraction. So effectively what it's doing is it's compressing and expanding what's called space-time, infinitesimally little. And so that wave, as it comes through, changes the distance that the light has to go and then to come back. And that's what they measured.
And so one side of the L got a little shorter and the other side got a little longer.
Exactly. And as a result, the amount of time it took the light to get back from its original source was slightly different. That's why it's called an interferometer.
Right. So it's not an amplitude modulation or a frequency modulation.
It's the distance.
It's the distance modulation.
Okay.
Thanks,
Thank you,
Bob. We appreciate it. Over to Michael in Schenectady. Michael, you're on.
Hi there. I've heard a lot and seen a lot about the M drive lately. And I'm curious as to whether or not, first of all, is the M drive considered a real scientific interest? And secondly, if these gravitational waves are detected and now maybe could be predicted, can that used to be a boosting power system to the M drive?
Silence, crickets, silence.
M drive?
What's an M drive?
I've never heard of an M drive.
You've never heard of the EM drive?
Nope.
It's been tested by NASA recently. It supposedly uses quantum fluctuations and looks at the harmonics of those quantum fluctuations and actually produces thrust from those fluctuations. It's been reported in many places.
Yeah, I think I actually have read something about this.
Okay. Yeah, I think that this is on the very fringes of the likely. And again, gravitational waves are so incredibly weak.
Yeah.
That there's
only here they're weak. They were probably quite strong when they started.
Yes. Yeah, if you're near a place where they're strong, you have a lot of other problems. But
well, would you even know? In other words, if over the past 2,000 years there have been big black holes out there in the blackness of space that have collided and created a sizable, maybe not a tidal wave, but a decent-sized gravity wave, would we even know about the compression and expansion that happens very quickly? Thank you.
Well, we could, because it's like dropping a rock in the rock in a stream. So you would have these sort of compression-extension events, and maybe, you know, time would dilate or change ever so slightly.
But if you were in the middle of that, would you even notice?
Well, if
you're on the event horizon of a black hole, would you even know that
you'd be dead?
Yeah, well, you would. There's going to be a lot of other radiation coming out. You'd be fried.
And very elongated as well. It would not be a good place to be.
But would you know you were elongated? That's my question.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Well, provided that your brain could get the signal from your feet.
There's a pull-my-finger joke that I will not discuss right now.
I'm glad. By the way, my producer handed me a sheet. M-drive, EM-drive, radio frequency resonant cavity thruster.
Is this homework? Do we have homework from
Jessica?
Yeah,
okay, there's your sheet.
Oh,
yes.
My gosh, you give it to the least mechanical person on
Fine.
The table.
Well, let's go
well,
to
it's quantum mechanics,
well,
so I can handle that.
Cavities are biological, aren't they?
Let's go to Robin in Albany. Robin, help us out of this.
Well, I can certainly change the subject.
Good!
I was going to ask a very speculative question about evolutionary biology, if I may.
All right.
Go for it.
So I've been fixated for a while on locusts, on the idea that sort of mild-mannered grasshoppers can experience a condition, say somebody planted a monoculture of something we like to eat, and that doesn't change them, but it changes their next generation, flips a switch somewhere. By the idea that maybe that maybe intergenerational switches like this, which seems like that could only crop up after a very long time evolving, might be present in other species, possibly humans, for example, bookmark that. And also that it only makes sense to have such a mechanism if you're also constantly listening for a signal to change back the other way. So this hardly amounts to a question. I'm just curious for what thoughts come to your scientific brains when you hear about this, and also whether I've got anything wrong.
Okay.
Actually, I thought that your fixation, actually, you articulated it really well. So the idea is you've got a mild-mannered grasshopper in a population that's doing its normal thing. There's this upset somehow ecologically, which takes the next generation and says, get it while you can, fire sale, fire sale, fire sale. And their behaviors change from kind of this mild-mannered population that lives in harmony with everything else to let's eat the kitchen furniture. So... and then is that an evolutionary switch that we can monitor its turning on and turning off, I think was the last part of that question. Is that correct?
Yeah, something like that. And you know, where else in the biosphere might more subtle versions of this be lurking?
Well, I mean, the presumption is that they're everywhere. The genetics have not yet, to my knowledge, been identified, and it's most likely not DNA per se, but rather the expression or suppression of DNA through what's called the epigenome, which is a regulation of expression of genes. So not all of my genes are expressed at one time. If you've ever met, I'll get away from grasshoppers for a second, and go to a human that has straight hair prepubescent, but then curly hair postpubescent, on the head, that is the expression of genes that have been turned on through some of the hormonal processes. So we have the whole genome in our cells, but then only a fraction of it is expressed at any one time. And it could be that there is a cascade of ecological switches that can turn on or off an epigenome within animals. And I do think humans have this capability to kind of locust out.
Well, this is neat. Now, maybe over the last, like, say, 5,000 years, humans have been acting very poorly, which we have.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice?
And then maybe at some point we'll all just become, like, rational and normal and peaceful. What do you think?
Let's methylate ourselves and find out.
I'm sorry? Yeah. To do what?
To methylate. I usually do that right before the show. Well, is that what you call it?
Yeah.
So that's the that's one of the ways that in the laboratory we can simulate this epigenome. We can turn on and off certain genes in DNA by sticking methyl groups on to make them not readable. Kind of make them garbage so that the body can't express it.
Well, that would be really, there's hope for the future, you know, for humanity.
Epigenetics is enormously powerful, and we have just only tapped that in the last 10 years.
Anybody else want to jump in? Want to tie this into gravity waves in any way?
Can you think of other organisms besides the locust that kind of locust out?
Yeah, well, I can think of people, which are getting much, much heavier over time, simply because they're able to eat a lot more. My feeling is that a lot of the epigenetic history effectively probably comes from our past experiences as creatures, things that got turned off because it turned out they weren't particularly useful to us right now, but we still have them around and they could come back again.
There are definitely environmental and inherited epigenetic markers. So if you look in the lab, what they've noticed is that the ecological environment of the grandparents, both female and male, impact the epigenetic expression of their grandchildren. Hmm. So my grandmother, who smoked like a chimney, has affected me even though I'm two generations down.
Really?
That's the assumption. Yep.
Very
interesting. But those effects tend to dampen out over time.
Like gravity waves.
Beyond the second generation, I can't say. But that's pretty profound if you think about it.
All right, we have covered some good territory here on the Vox Pop Science Forum. We will cover some more territory in the home stretch. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Northshire Bookstore, presenting Sari Wilson, Girl Through Glass, February 25th, and Debbie McComber, A Girl's Guide to Moving, February 26th, in Saratoga Springs, New York. Northshire.com. The Nature Conservancy's Adirondack Chapter, working to protect ecologically important lands and waters of the Adirondacks for nature and people. Nature.org/Adirondacks. Union College Concert Series, presenting the Modigliani String Quartet. The French Ensemble offers a program featuring Dvorak's American Quartet. February 21st, 3 p.m., unioncollegeconcerts.org. And the Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, educating children pre-K through grade 12 and striving to inspire a lifelong love of learning. WaldorfSaratoga.org.
And welcome back to the Science Forum on WAMC Vox Pop. Number to call is 800-348-2551. Ray Graff here. We're joined by the geniuses, Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander. Nice to have you all here.
We're glad to be here, too.
If you'd like me to beat the epigenetic locust thing to death, I did think of an example. There was a psych study where they took rats and kept them in relatively spacious cages, and they behaved a certain way and had certain biomarkers in their blood. But when they put them into an urban rat environment, so they made their cages smaller and made them be in contact with other males, then they saw a genetic expression that was different than when they were by themselves. So
is that going to happen with chickens now?
I don't know.
Gotta watch out for that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Nico in Duanesburg. Nico, you're up.
Hi, thank you. Okay, so a couple quick thoughts. The previous caller talking about the EM drive, he is referring to a concept called the Casimir effect, and that ties into what I believe he was trying to talk about, which was the Alcubierre drive, which basically uses the concept of gravitational waves to make a spacecraft that compresses time in front and expands space-time rapidly behind, thus allowing space-time to move around the individual inside of this, you know, bubble.
How are you going to create that much power?
That's
though?
Pretty close to the infinite.
What happens is, in his theoretical derivations, if you plug in negative energy used, which is derived from the Casimir effect, you can actually twist space and time to your liking. So,
there was a
whole other debate because it would still require a massive amount of negative energy.
Right.
Well, they ought to listen to the roundtable panel. You'll hear plenty of negative energy.
It sounds an awful lot like the philosopher drive.
The philosopher drive?
Right, where a bunch of philosophers, this is true, it was a suggestion that was made years and years ago in the science fiction community that you get a bunch of philosophers together and they decide where they're going to be and put themselves there.
I like it. Nico, thanks a lot for that call, and we've had some interesting calls today. Boy, Sean in Kinderhook. Sean, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Listen, is anybody familiar with mass in motion?
Could you be more specific?
Well, here, for instance, this is what I don't understand. You know when you had your 10-speed bicycle and you had the little generator that was on your tire and it powered your light?
Right.
So you could think, okay, so why doesn't every boxcar on a train generate electricity to power the train? You understand? The train will use gas to get the mass in motion.
Yeah.
You understand? And then once it's moving... Why doesn't the wheels generate power to power the locomotive? Right.
If I may, it's very simply answered by friction. You can't get something from nothing according to the laws of thermodynamics, and that effectively is the problem with that.
Yeah.
So it's diminishing returns.
Your bicycle generator makes you work harder to move the bicycle.
Right.
That energy isn't coming for free. That energy is coming from your legs. So if you put those generators on the train cars, then the locomotive has to burn more fuel to pull the train. There's no free lunch.
However, hybrid technology takes a energy that we give off when we try to stop a wheel and converts it instead of to heat, it converts it to electrical energy, which is stored to help supplement when we need to move forward, not stop.
But the key is supplement.
It's supplement.
We're not producing energy, we're saving energy.
Yes. All right, let's go to Jeff and Gardner. Jeff, you're on.
Good afternoon. I've been hearing and seeing some articles about this terrible methane leak in Southern California along that first ridge there.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if anybody could help me get an idea about the scope of this or effects of it. How bad is it? Does anybody have an opinion about that?
It's one of the problems with methane underground. I think it's 1,500 feet or no, it's more than that. It's several thousand feet underground. There's a methane leak. And what happens is it's getting up into the pipe or around the pipe and then getting into the water supply from there. It's the same problem that you have, for example, with fracking, where you don't close the well well enough. You don't case the well properly so that the gas comes up on a very, very simple surface, like a fracture surface, and from there it can get into wherever it wants to.
It kind of goes back to that pressure question about the ocean. You have this pressurized methane, and then you have a pressure differential as it travels through the water. The gas probably started as a really small quantity volume-wise, but that volume expands as it gets to the surface, and then when it comes in contact with the air, you get a combustible mixture. It's the big bubble that starts small at the bottom and becomes really big at the top because the pressure is different.
Jeff, thanks a lot.
It's pretty awful.
Yeah, it's actually the same way diamonds are made, though. It's the same thing happens. You get a big bubble of methane down around the bottom of the Earth's crust. It breaks through. It comes up. And as it comes up at the speed of sound, it starts to expand.
Huh.
And that's what the diamonds are formed at the bottom, come up at the surface.
So no kimberlite diamonds going to come up in Southern California, though, huh?
Unfortunately, not deep enough.
Oh, well.
Number to call here is 800-348-2551. It is the Science Forum on WAMC Vox Pop. And over to Joseph in Rotterdam. Joseph.
Hi. How many years do we have left to drill for natural gas and oil before...
Whoops. Oh, mercy. Uh-oh. Well, I hit
know
the wrong
answer.
Button, but we know the question, Joseph. I apologize. I was hitting the cough button and I turned you off. So how much left?
There's lots of variability, but less than 100 years.
Yeah,
and actually much less than 100 years.
Yeah, they figure 20 to 30 years in terms of gas itself. Although the fracking of natural gas that we're doing now has got a much longer lifetime, probably about 100 years.
Right. So it used to be 60, but then the technology got a little bit better with fracking. So it's more than 60 and less than 100. Okay. I know that sounds like
that's for
like
natural
a hand
gas?
Wave.
What about for oil?
That's pretty much all of the fossil fuels that are...
much less.
Yeah. That's everything.
The big problem with oil is not that there's not that much down there, but the fact that it takes a lot to refine it and get it out of the ground.
More right. energy.
And so what we've done is we've reached that point effectively right now, or maybe a couple of years ago, where we can't refine enough to produce. Now, at the moment, of course, the price is going down because people are refining a lot more than is necessary.
Right.
But generally speaking, we're just going through it very quickly.
And we need the energy to capture the other energy that's hard to capture. So we're using the oil that's easier to get in order to technologically glean more fossil fuel from other means like fracking.
Yeah. At some point, there will still be a lot of oil under the ground, but it will require more than 1 gallon's worth of energy
to
get the oil out.
And so fossil fuels were created by... dead critters.
Decaying dead things.
And so this is it's a renewable
fossil
source.
It's a fossil source.
It's a millennially renewable source. Instead of annually renewable, it takes millennia.
Okay, how many millennia?
Yeah, that's a geology question.
Thank you. Most of the stuff that's down there, for example, in Pennsylvania is from the Carboniferous period.
Which was about
120 million years ago.
Okay.
And so it has to be under a lot of pressure. It needs a lot of heat to get the stuff mobilized. And that takes a very, very, very long time.
Okay, so dead dinosaurs or whatever they were back 120 million years
ago.
Trees. Okay, and so they how do they get that far down?
Well, more stuff gets piled up on top of them.
Mm-hmm. Pressurized.
Sediment gets piled up continuously in the oceans, pushes them down further and further, effectively.
So
and
it's compressed.
As a result, right? And in the case of oil, what usually happens is an ocean opens nearby, and heat from the mantle is able to get up to that site to produce the oil.
Okay.
And salt is key to that, too, somehow.
Yeah. The salt isn't key to it. The salt is necessary to trap the oil.
Ah.
As the salt rises, because it's much lighter than the rock around it, it forms traps, and that's where the oil gets trapped.
Now I understand, after all these years. Let's go to Joan in Dolgeville. Joan, you're on.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a question about a light phenomenon, and I think I've heard it explained before, maybe even on your show, but I cannot keep the answer in my head. This is something that happens often when I'm out walking at night in the wintertime or snowshoeing. When it's dark and there's no moon that's actually casting a shadow, which it does on snow quite often, it seems that... when one is walking, and there may be some ambient light, although I live in a rural area, that as you walk, it's like there's light behind you, almost like there's a halo coming from your body or something. Is there any explanation for that? Does anybody know what I'm talking about?
I think we need some more information.
I could only... guess that, are you talking, what happens if it's ice and not snow? Do you still get it?
Oh, well, I wouldn't be walking on a field of ice.
Hmm.
I don't know.
What if, like last month when we had no snow, you were walking and it was moonlit in winter, but it was ground? You don't have that effect, right?
Oh, well, if it was moonlit, then I would have an explanation for that.
Sure.
No, when it's grass, it must have something to do with the reflection of the light on the snow, because I don't feel that sort of thing going on, like there's light behind me walking on a field of grass.
Hmm.
I'm not aware of that phenomenon.
How do you see the light behind you?
How do I see it? I mean, it as I walk and look forward, it's as though there's a glow behind.
Huh. Well, I've not heard this one on this program, Joan, but that's a great one. I think you stumped the panel.
Well, I hope I don't sound like I'm crazy.
well, the snow outside, I'll go for a walk tonight and see what I can find. Although it's a new full moon.
And it's also going to be about, wind chill of 20 below. So
have
maybe you're not.
Right,
what I'm
going to
be seeing is the heat coming off
tonight.
Of me, right?
I probably will walk myself.
Have you not seen Dr. Stander's face? I mean, the radio crowd, he's on sabbatical. He looks like Grizzly Adams.
He does look like Grizzly Adams. Tell you what, Joan, we'll call this homework, and we'll all try to reproduce this, and maybe you give us a call next time.
Okay.
Thank you
very much.
Bye now. Over to Mark in Saugerties. Mark, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a comment. I guess it's sort of a question. When you were talking about hydropower earlier, and you referred to it as the energy was coming from gravity, but isn't it solar energy really? It's
well,
like
ultimately,
the water is raised by the sun up to a higher level, and that gives it this potential energy.
Yes.
Ultimately, it's all solar energy.
Yes. It's just we get the extra piece of that Carnot cycle, the cycle up versus down. The gravity is that last little piece, and we use that trick to be able to harness it. Because you have to defy gravity in order to evaporate and rise, correct? So that energy is already put in to defy gravity to go up.
And that's
right. So the potential energy is the drop, or is realized in the drop, but the rise of the water, the raising of the water, is done by the sun.
Right.
Right. Except in the case of peak hydro plants, where they actually pump the water up to let it go down later.
Right. What they do is they pump energy when it's excess on the grid, and then so-called cheap energy, same number of electrons, moves the gravity up, or goes against gravity, brings the water up to the top of the mountain, and then in peak times when there's more of a demand for energy, they run it through the hydro system to add energy back
to
the grid.
It's
just a big battery, really.
Right, except to get the water to the top, you use
solar
energy.
You use more than you get, right.
Yeah. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. It is the Science Forum on WAMC, and the number to call is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We're joined by Barbara Brabets and Jim Pickett and Ed Stander and you at home. And over to Lynn in Shelburne Falls. Lynn.
Hi, yes. Yes, I have a question concerning, I might be stupid, actually, but I would need a deeper well here in the country, and it kind of dries up in the summer sometimes. And I'm wondering if fracking is going to be a problem. I mean, I don't want to frack. Frack is a dirty word these days.
Hydrofrack.
You mean in order to dig a new well?
No. You're talking about hydrofracking. And what you're doing there is you're breaking the rock around the well to increase the amount of crack so that more water goes into the well.
Yes, that's what he told me.
Yes, and there's
no
problem.
Okay, sorry.
With that.
Bye. Thank you.
All right, Lynn. Thanks a lot. I think we were getting an answer there. So that's common to
it's
do?
Common.
Yes, it's very, very common.
Well, drillers will either drill or hydrofrack, and usually you pay a little bit more for the hydrofracking, but you may not need to go so deep because you'll get fissures that start all along the whole diameter of your drill, if you want.
Your well.
At your well sides, and it will contribute water to the overall volume you get.
All right, let's go to John in Gilderland. John, you're on.
Hi. I was wondering if you build a road perpendicular to Earth's surface and drive a car up it, do you ever drive uphill?
Oh, my gosh. Now we've got to do imagery on a radio.
I love this. Okay, good.
Boy.
I'm going to relax for the last minute and a half of the program. You go.
Oh, perpendicular. Towards the sun perpendicular?
Sure,
or
yeah,
on its side?
Into outer space. It doesn't really matter.
Do I drive uphill?
Well, yeah.
You mean like space shuttle?
Because you're going up against gravity, yeah.
It's the gravity show, folks.
Yeah. So yes, you'd be going straight uphill.
So the entire time you're going uphill?
Well,
when wouldn't you be?
If you're not talking about the Earth's rotation, you're still going uphill. But as the Earth rotates underneath you, of course, you'll be going uphill at a slightly different angle if you're not being affected by gravity. But otherwise,
because there's gravity essentially extends infinitely. It just gets weaker and weaker and weaker.
Right.
For example, the misconception often is that the astronauts are weightless in the space station because they are outside of the Earth's gravity. And that's absolutely false. Mm-hmm. The gravity there is almost exactly the same as here. They're just falling with style. So the gravity extends for very, very, far measurably.
Okay. Well, we grabbed a moon. We got a moon. Yeah. That's gravity.
That's sure. A good point. We did grab a moon. And
thank
you know,
heavens.
We're back where we began. Thank you for the call. We're back to gravity waves and gravity and no escaping it on this program, really.
We do tend to get in themes, don't
it's
we?
It's been a very heavy show.
hey, massive indeed. That was great. Well, thank you, Barbara and Jim and Ed, for being here with us today.
I would like to add at the end that anybody who wants to know more about gravity waves should surf the net, because surfing on gravity waves is incredibly interesting.
He had to get it in.
He did.
He had
he
to
warned
get the
us.
Joke in. Well, on that somewhat down note, we'll end the program. Thanks for calling, everybody. Thanks for listening. Support comes from Albany Realty Group, a local woman-owned real estate company since 2003, educating, counseling sellers and buyers throughout the real estate transaction, albanyrealtygroup.com. ClipCentric Albany, a local video services division of ClipCentric, producing video advertisements for businesses throughout the capital region for web, mobile, and TV, albany.clipcentric.com. And Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. Over 300 flavors of handcrafted dairy and dairy-free ice creams, cakes, hot fudge, and more. Harold's.com. Thanks to Jim, Barbara, and Ed for being with us. Thanks to you for listening and for all the great calls. Thanks to Zach Malloy at the controls. Your phones were answered by Deb Malik, our producer, Jessica Blaustein. Marshall, I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we bring you a delicious food Friday. I believe Rick Orlando will be in the house. Stay tuned now for a news update.